Hello, listeners. Welcome to the April 18th, 2024 episode of Social Skills Coaching, where you become more likable, more charismatic, and more productive. Today, we're diving into another chapter of Make Friends Easily by Patrick King. The chapter is titled When Ego Gets in the Way, and it tackles the challenges of navigating conversations and dealing with difficult personalities. Stay tuned as we explore how to cooperatively overlap in conversation without interrupting, and discover how to adapt your communication style across cultures. We'll also be discussing the gray rock technique, a powerful tool for dealing with conversational narcissists. If you'd like to learn more about Patrick King or his book, Make Friends Easily, visit his website at bit.ly/PK Consulting. That's bit.ly/PK Consulting. There's not too much more to say about interrupting. It's bad and undermines rapport. But what about when interrupting isn't interrupting, but cooperative overlapping? A professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, Deborah Tannen, coined the term cooperative overlapping, CO, and explains how it's very different from interrupting. CO is about talking along with the speaker, not to undermine or cut them off, but to validate what they're saying, give encouragement, and show that they're paying close attention. She alternatively calls it participatory listenership and enthusiastic listenership, and explains how different cultures have different expectations about this behavior. Some people find, for example, that in certain countries or cities, interrupting is considered a normal and lively part of conversation, and it eases and encourages conversation rather than stops it. Cooperative overlapping is said to be common in Jewish New Yorkers, for example, who nevertheless find that others may see their communication style as too aggressive. Where they might feel that an overlapping, excitable conversation signals full engagement, others might see this as a sign that nobody's really listening to one another, and consider all interruptions to be a sign of rudeness. The real problem only comes in when communication styles are not matched or aligned. When two different types try to talk, the interrupted speaker can get thrown out of whack and may stop speaking altogether or feel quite offended. This can create awkwardness all around. What to do? According to Tannen, it's not an insurmountable problem once you're aware of what's going on. If you don't know someone well, try to get a sense early on what their style might be like. If they appear to be a cooperative overlapper and you're not, you can safely assume that you can carry on talking if they interject before you're finished. See it as a sign that they are listening and engaged with what you're saying, in effect, helping you say it, and take your time finishing and completing your point. When they're talking, try interjecting more often and see what responses you get. It may feel a little strange at first, but you might find that more nonverbal engagement from you actually makes the conversation flow better. If you yourself are the cooperative overlapper, be patient with people who might not be. If you chip in with a comment and they stop speaking, say something like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I wasn't interrupting you." If you find they're getting flustered, try to limit your responses to nonverbal ones while they're talking. For example, nodding your head, gestures, facial expressions, and eye contact. Try to be alert of the different kinds of interrupting or overlapping. Transitional overlap. This is where someone jumps in and starts speaking close to the end, or what they think might be the end, of what the other person is saying. We've hired older folks. We've hired kids out of school. I can tell you, we have a very diverse mix of employees. We'll hire anyone. What matters is your work ethic and whether you can get the job done. That's all that matters. I tell the interns that come through here, I tell them that it doesn't matter how much experience you have, but it's like some people think it's enough just to have the qualifications, just to be good on paper, when actually you need to have a certain attitude as well, right? In this exchange, B is definitely interrupting, but in a way that doesn't really cut A off, but adds fuel to what they're saying. If A was also a cooperative overlapper, they would interrupt B in just the same way. Recognitional overlap, basically finishing a person's sentence. We've hired older folks, we've hired kids out of school. I can tell you, we have a very diverse mix of employees. We'll hire anyone. What matters is your work ethic and whether you can get the job done. That's all that matters. I tell the interns that come through here, I tell them that it doesn't matter how much experience you have, but it's your mindset. Exactly. Progressional overlap. This is when the first speaker is having difficulty expressing themselves, and the second speaker interrupts to help cover over the gap and keep the conversation progressing. I tell the interns that come through here, I tell them, it doesn't matter how much experience you have, but it's your mindset, your outlook, like your perspective on things. Yeah, exactly. Your mindset. That's the thing that actually makes the difference, and blah, blah, blah. Back-channel interrupting. In some cultures, and in some contexts, people may like to frequently interject while a person is speaking precisely to support, encourage, and engage with what they're hearing. Strictly, they are interrupting, but the intention is the same as a support response. Japanese speakers, for example, may listen closely and repeatedly say, so, 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 throughout, which is a phatic expression that's a little like verbal cheerleading from the sidelines. African Americans may do something similar when they interject with expressions like, uh-huh, or yeah, or I hear that, while someone is talking. Rather than either of these cultural practices being rude, they're actually a sign of active and respectful participation, or, if you like, a culturally unique way of listening. Some people may be happy to overlap in some environments but not in others. It might feel fun to talk all at once when out on the town with friends, for example, but it can be overwhelming and confusing to do so when trying to solve a difficult problem as a group or in a professional context. Overlapping may also depend on other factors, such as gender, class, culture, and context. It may be tolerated by some in big groups, but not when in pairs, or it may be a behavior reserved for some occasions but not others. Whatever the case, Tannen believes that no style is better or worse than another, only that it's worth recognizing the differences and keeping them in mind when you're trying to connect with someone a little different from yourself. Don't automatically assume that a person interrupting you doesn't care about what you're saying, or that the person who is listening quietly without interjecting isn't engaged with the story you're telling. Mastering turn-taking. You've probably never thought about it before, but knowing exactly when it's your turn to speak in a conversation is actually a rather complex question, and is resolved using many different conventions and norms. The way people organize themselves in conversations is a kind of meta-conversation, a social agreement that everyone speaking will follow the rough rules for engagement. People in cultures of all kinds can agree that turn-taking should take place. It's just that they often disagree on the exact rules. How is airtime divided? How do you signal a change in turn? How long is each turn? If you find yourself repeatedly having difficulty in conversations, it may be that there's some friction or misunderstanding in turn-taking. Imagine that every contribution to a conversation takes a particular structure. There's the introduction, the content or message itself, and the ending, where the speaker signals that their turn has ended and they're giving up the floor to someone else. There may also be other rules, such as not leaving too much empty space between turns, and not having more than one person have the floor at a time, with the exception of enthusiastic listening. So, what are these rules? Well, that depends on who you are, where you are, and what you're doing. A big part of learning to be charming, likable, and a good communicator is to constantly be appraising the situation and adapting and adjusting yourself accordingly. Someone may signal that their turn is over and that you can begin your turn by using eye contact. They might talk for some time and then make eye contact with you when they're done, like serving the conversational tennis ball back to you. Pitch and tone of voice. They may suddenly change these in a way that communicates that they're concluding their contribution. Body language. Different gestures can indicate that it is now your turn. The speaker can also signal they're finished by sitting back in their seat, crossing their arms, or adopting some other closing movement. Verbal cues. A question is a very obvious one, but people can signal that they want you to jump in by mentioning your name directly, referring to you or your opinion, or saying something like, "I imagine you and I differ on that, though," followed by a pause. Slowing down or pausing. Some people, especially those who favor an overlapping style, will sometimes literally stop in the middle of a sentence or slow right down. "And I was just like," followed by a shrug, indicates that the person probably doesn't intend to finish their thought. In some cultures, though, saying, "you know," or its equivalent, is not necessarily an indication that the turn has ended, but could be more of an invitation for support responses like, "yeah," or "uh-huh." Linguists and anthropologists have studied turn-taking behavior for decades, and it's a rich and fascinating area. All you need to know, as a budding good conversationalist and social butterfly, is to be aware that these rules exist in the first place, and that they may not always be the same from one situation to the next. When you become aware of two people talking at once during a conversation, that's your cue to notice it and try to understand it. Is someone, maybe you, interrupting? Is it cooperative overlapping? Do you and your conversational partner have different communication styles? In a group, what is the general consensus for the rules, and how can you match to that? When they're the conversational narcissist. We'll end this book on a topic that's probably been lingering in your mind throughout. How do you deal with someone else who isn't a good listener, isn't charming, and is a conversational narcissist? How do you deal with endless shift responses or being interrupted? There's no point denying it. It takes two to tango, and if only one person in a conversation is listening actively, asking questions, and maintaining curiosity, that conversation is not going to go anywhere. A word of warning, the more you improve your own conversational skills, the more you may notice how poor other people's are. One big mistake you can make when encountering a conversational narcissist is to imagine that you can elevate things or rescue the conversation simply by being more attentive, understanding, and charming yourself. More realistically, what tends to happen is that you don't rescue the conversational narcissist, but rather they suck you in. And soon, you may find yourself competing with them and even resorting to your own tactics to wrestle the focus back from them and onto yourself. In other words, often the only possible way of talking with a narcissist is to become one yourself. Instead, take a neutral and rational position. You cannot force self-absorbed people to pay attention to you, so don't waste energy trying. If someone is incapable of genuinely seeing you, hearing you, or acknowledging you as a separate and valuable person, there is seldom anything you can or should do to change their mind. At best, you can pay attention and see if there's anything you can learn from them, i.e. what not to do, and then move swiftly on. Using the gray rock technique is a way to protect yourself while maintaining your own standard of politeness. Basically, being a gray rock means being unresponsive to manipulation. It's a way of holding your own and making sure that you're not being ensnared by another person's attempts to dominate a conversation, mistreat you, or make you feel bad. Sometimes conversational narcissists create their own reality distortion field that can influence you, but only if you let it. When you believe you may be in the presence of a conversational narcissist, consciously adopt the attitude of a gray rock. Boring, dull, unresponsive. The reason is that narcissists do what they do because they want all attention to be on them. Make it clear that you're not really a viable source for this attention, and they'll lose interest. While most of the time you would be interested in increasing intimacy and closeness, with such a person you want to do the opposite. Keep things shallow, neutral, and banal. Be as impersonal as possible. You're not violently pushing against them. You're just like a gray rock that doesn't do much of anything. You're bland. Remind yourself that your full, genuine, and empathetic attention is not a free-for-all, but is something reserved for those people who can see it and appreciate it. For those who can't, your only obligation is to be polite. That's for your benefit, not theirs. Disengage if necessary. Never become defensive, sensitive, upset, or reactive. Don't give them any information, buttons to push, or handles to grab you by, but keep responses neutral and short. If you're feeling insulted or triggered, don't show it. Just manage the conversation as it is, and disengage as soon as it's realistic to do so. Manage your interactions with this person. Not everyone has the luxury of permanently avoiding a conversational narcissist. If you have to be around them, put buffers in place. You can ensure there's always an activity going on to distract you and give an excuse to escape. You could make sure you're never alone with them, or you could orchestrate meetings that have a natural but definite end. Keep it light and make sure you're not giving them an opportunity to insert themselves or dominate. Don't be a doormat. In ordinary conversation, active listening, questions, and support responses tend to create more trust, liking, and understanding between people. Those who are secure in themselves will respond well and be happy to return the kindness and listen carefully to you when it's your turn to speak. Show this kindness to a conversational narcissist, however, and you're only inviting them to walk all over you. If you're in the presence of someone who cannot talk about anything other than themselves, give yourself permission not to ask them questions or give endless support responses. You'll only leave the conversation feeling resentful and as though you've been taken advantage of. Tighten up boundaries. The boundary that most needs defending is often the one around your time. Keep interactions with them as brief as possible. Don't share secrets or self-disclose, nor respond to their self-disclosures. Don't take any emotional bait, but breezily move on from tricky topics. Be aloof, but civil. Decide on the emotional frame that you want to hold, then stay there. If someone interrupts you, for example, don't sit there seething quietly while you let them talk, but at the same time, don't get visibly upset and interrupt them in return. Calmly say, "Oh, oops, I wasn't finished speaking yet," then continue to speak. If it keeps happening, make your excuses and end the conversation. With non-narcissistic people, it's wise to assume the best and keep trying to push past any awkwardness for the sake of that precious rapport and connection. With a conversational narcissist, however, the best strategy goes the other way. Cut your losses early and leave. The world is full of interesting, attentive people who you can connect with instead. put it into practice. The final exercise is about boundaries. This book has been about creating connection, conversation, and friendships, but sometimes what's needed is to reduce the number of poor connections we have and draw a line against unhealthy conversation or friendships that have run their course. Try now to identify a current social habit in your life that you are ready to let go of, whether that's interrupting others or allowing others to interrupt you, talking about yourself too much, or not asserting yourself enough when others talk over you. Perhaps, in a bid to improve your social life overall, you might like to think about a particular relationship that you'd like to minimize or detach from. Developing great social skills means you can improve any relationship and be calmer, more confident, and more likable. At the same time, not every person can and should be your friend. Sometimes the best thing we can do is to be honest about the people, behavior, and relationships that we're no longer happy with, and have the courage to move on from them so we can make more room for the kinds of connections we really want. Summary. The biggest threat to connecting well with others is conversational narcissism, i.e., the tendency of centering ourselves, talking too much, steering the topic, interrupting, invalidating others, bragging, manipulating, or acting superior to others. Everyone has the potential to be narcissistic in conversation at times. A shift response is an attempt to bring the focus and attention of a conversation back to yourself. A support response maintains that focus and attention on the other person. A great way to reduce conversational narcissism is to use fewer shift responses and more support responses. When used well, support responses lead to better, more fulfilling conversations for everyone. Dr. Carl Albrecht says that all conversations can be broken down into three fundamental components: declaratives, questions, and conditionals. His rule of three is to never make three declarative statements in a row without a question or conditional statement. Declarations can be presented as statements of fact, whether they are or aren't, and can shut down conversations or act as shift responses. Conditionals are modified, weaker forms of declarations that acknowledge their own subjectivity. Cooperative overlapping is different from interrupting. It's about talking along with the speaker, not to undermine or cut them off, but to validate what they're saying, give encouragement, and show that they're paying close attention. It can vary across cultures. Neither way is right, but try to acknowledge and accommodate differences. Turn-taking rules can be complex and culture-bound, but a big part of learning to be charming, likable, and a good communicator is to constantly be appraising the situation and adapting and adjusting yourself accordingly. When dealing with a conversational narcissist, don't try to rescue the conversation by being more attentive, understanding, and charming yourself, or you'll be taken advantage of. Instead, use the gray rock technique and be aloof and unresponsive until they lose interest and minimize contact as much as possible. Tighten up boundaries. All right, listeners, that's all for today's episode on navigating conversations and keeping your ego in check. Remember, communication is a dance, and with little practice, you can become a smoother, more confident mover on the social dance floor. For more tips on building your social skills, subscribe to Social Skills Coaching wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review to let us know what you think. We'll see you next time.